What is it? She's so excited. What is it? Well, I'd like to welcome everybody here this morning, especially Jane. We talked to her a couple days ago and visited, and she was going to try to make it today, and she did. Way to go, Jane and Kane. So thanks for all of you who are here for attending this morning's service. And welcome. So we speakers, I say that because there are quite a few speakers, five of us that do messages on Sunday mornings, are theming some of our Sundays for the upcoming weeks with a continuation of the idea that Brother Brian and Micah had in their last sermons, which Micah preached last week and Brian did the week before. Both of them had a line in their sermon that kind of caught my attention. And they were the last two to speak. Both of them included in their message, "What shall we do then?" or "Now what should we do?" In Micah's case, it was the question the soon-to-be converts or the new Christians felt something had to change to better their situation in the eyes of God and of Christ. They needed to do something to change. What shall we do? What can we do to change, to be better in the eyes of God and Christ? They felt in their hearts that they would be on the short end of the stick if they didn't do something. So I think there's a mixture of gratitude and fear, probably, in their response, "What should we do?" That idea of "What should we do?" is the inspiration of the next batch of messages by how do we take this personally? And us say, "What shall we do then?" Speaking of Sundays, which I was just talking about, the next few Sundays we'll have different subjects on that line. I wanted y'all to be aware that might be the first time I said "y'all" in a message. So Gordon Landry's legacy, I, a Yankee, said "y'all." If you didn't know Gordon, he's not a Yankee. He was from the South and would say "y'all" frequently, but I always said "you." But he says "y'all." So "I, a Yankee, said y'all." Is it "I" or "me"? I think it's "I," right? Yeah, because you'd have to say it individually to make it make sense. So he made me say "y'all." Back to the Sundays for the rest of this month. In June, next week, it's Mother's Day. The first Sunday in June, we're having a kids' day with a message geared to our many kids. Not many, but many kids, which we have a lot. We also have a dinner that Sunday, June 1st. It's the first Sunday with a kids' theme for our... I wanted to have everybody think about what do kids want to eat and theme our dinner as well for the kids. Then on June 15th, it's Father's Day. So these are for people that don't remember well. You can also take notes and remember these different days. So we will have some celebration Sundays mixed in with our theme, so it won't be all in a row because, after all, next Sunday is Mother's Day, and we're not going to change the theme from Mother's Day, I'm sure. So before I actually begin the message, I wanted to give a shout-out to Kelsey Ann, whose baby I recently saw on Jennifer's phone. And I saw the baby, and I looked at it, and I said, "Oh, Theo." So it wasn't Theo, it was Imani. I thought it was Theo, a cousin of Imani. They're cousins. So maybe they're twin cousins, because I'm telling you what, they look the same. I know that I've been known in some of my sermons, my great unboring sermons, I've been known to put Imani to sleep with my sermon. So perhaps some of you guys too. But I'm not going to take any offense to that I could put somebody to sleep on my watch. That's fine. After all, even Paul had one fall asleep while he was preaching. He fell asleep and then fell out the window. And if you don't know that story, you can get that account in Acts 20, 7 through 12. Paul's preaching all night long. It says that he was preaching And it got midnight, and the guy fell asleep and fell out the window. Eutychus fell out of a third-floor window during Paul's sermon. So if you want to fall asleep, go ahead. But don't sit by the window. It might be a surprise to you to find out about me that I love to watch movies. I'm not sure. I'm not saying that it's a complete waste of time, because I've used them in sermons before, and I'm going to again today. So that's what I'm blaming my love of watching movies on, is it's helping me write sermons. Well, yeah, right. Sometimes a movie, especially a period piece like this one, helps us to consider or understand how things get the way they are, or how the world shapes and develops and turns out like it is now, or you didn't even know how bad it used to be. You think that things are bad now, but when you watch a movie that happened like a long time ago, they're reenacting, you think, are you kidding me? The people were acting like that? You didn't know how bad it was until you see it in a movie way back then. So I watched a movie this past week, I think it was, and I was horrified by the outcome. That's hard for me to get horrified, but the outcome, I didn't like it. I didn't want to push rewind, but I didn't like it, so I did a lot of research around it to see if that was really what happened, and it was interesting. So I will warn you of a spoiler alert. Spoiler alert! That's my warning. If you want to watch this movie and be surprised by it, fall asleep now. Just not by a window. But you can fall asleep now if you want to watch this movie later. If you hate my wide genre of movies, you probably won't watch it anyway. So if you're not going to watch it anyway, stay awake. If you're going to don't want to be spoiled, fall asleep. So the name of the movie was, or is, Agora. I don't know if any of you watched it. I see a lot of blanks, so no one has watched it. The movie is 2 hours and 21 minutes long, and it's set between the years of 390 and 414 AD. So it's like from, they didn't film it then, but the story is from then. Agora was a gathering place in the ancient Greek culture. An agora, it's an area. And it obviously bled into the Roman Empire, because at 400 AD, the Romans are in charge. The Greeks are behind, and the Romans have been in power for a long time. So this story takes place in Alexander, Egypt, which is still a current city. So the city is like 2,500 years old. It's an old city. Alexander, Egypt, which was under the arm of the Eastern Roman Empire, which the Eastern Roman Empire ruled what are the modern-day countries of Egypt, Israel, Turkey, Syria, Lebanon, and Cyprus. So it's like a rim around the Mediterranean Sea. The Eastern Roman Empire controlled or ruled that area. And Agora was a public place, usually in the middle of a town or by the harbor. A lot of the merchant towns were on the water's edge, and the Agora would be near the harbor so that people coming in could mix in and get supplies and things like that. It was mostly an enclosed area used for shops and social and religious activities. So it would be a section open, a section under roof, with open walls and archways and like a hodgepodge of buildings and openings put together. It was a big area, usually. If it was a big town, it was a big area. They used it for shops and things like that. They also would have public debates, things like that. And the storyline in this movie, Agora, is about Hypatia. I don't know if anybody's ever heard of her. Nope. You learn things here. This is a real person in history. It's not a documentary movie, but it's a period piece that there's a lot of argument about of how authentic it is. And some things are not argued about what happened, and some things are, which, being that long ago, the records probably aren't that great. You'll find out why. One of the reasons would be. Well, Hypatia was a woman, the daughter of the chief philosopher in Alexandria. The philosophers were known as the thinkers back in those days. I don't know if it was a title, but they were known as the thinkers, and they would sit around and debate and talk out and try to solve different mysteries that the world shows, whether they're natural things or whatever. Hypatia was a philosophy teacher and an astronomer and a mathematician. Did I say mathematician? I meant mathematician. So she's way above me already when I can't even say mathematician, let alone figure out a problem. So she was all three of those things and well-respected by the Christians and the philosophers, which the two were kind of like mixing oil and water. They did not mix well. She was an editor and made revisions in an early book that first showed the solar system with the planets and the orbits and some of the moons and stuff like that. So by 400, they were talking about those kinds of things and arguing about how could this be, how could that be, why are the stars where they are, and figuring out what's going on and whether the sun was revolving around the earth or the earth revolving around the sun. They would talk about and try to prove different things like that. She also wrote about the conic sections of a cone, the different angles that you make a slice, all have different properties and ways to figure out how those work. She was also a contemporary of St. Augustine of Hippo. I've mentioned him before in a different message a long time ago, I remember, because he was of Hippo, and I thought, that's a weird place, Hippo. But it is in Africa, so do hippos live in Africa? I think so, so that's probably why. It's probably where there are a lot of hippos. But anyway, St. Augustine of Hippo was in that same area, like I said. He was 300s to 450 around there. But he was a philosopher and a bishop. Remember what I said about the Christians and the philosophers? They don't get along. Well, St. Augustine was a philosopher and a bishop. So you can think about that for a minute. He mixed philosophy into a lot of the church, early church doctrines. He's one of the responsible people. Some other people did some earlier than him, but he has, there's pretty good documentation of things that he brought from Socrates and Plato into the beliefs. I'm not going to say into the Bible, but into the way people believe the Bible or what they believe about it. Anyway, in this agora, there was a philosophy library. There was a school and a library. And the library was not allowed to be entered by a Christian. You had to be a philosopher or a student of philosophy to be able to enter into the library. And of course, I don't know what it looked like, but in the movie, they had like a wine racks, big wine racks, the diamond shape with scrolls all over in there and had different writings and history, and there were a lot of them. It was a big place. But the Christians were not allowed to come in. And remember, the Christians and the philosophers didn't get along very well. And being Eastern Rome, it was part of the Roman Empire. Well, because of the unrest and reports that went back to Rome, Rome sent word to allow the Christians to enter. That was a big thing. So the guards came to tell the philosophers that the Christians were allowed to come in to open up the doors. They had it barred shut so they couldn't get in. open up the doors and let them come in. And they were trying to scavenge what they could out of the library and get away before the Christians came in. They could only take as much as they could carry. So then it came to the point where they escaped out the back. The Christians came in the front and they burned it down and condemned Hypatia, the philosophy leader. She was in charge of the group of philosophers because she would not convert to Christianity. So they executed her in a horrible way. I was going to tell you how, but I'm not. You have to look it up. So I didn't think it was that appropriate for here. She would not convert to Christianity, so they executed her in public. Spoiler alert is over. So if you were sleeping, now you can wake up. And so forth, stuff like that. So that was a movie I watched. And I liked it enough that it made me research a little bit about the era, a little bit about her, a little about the churches that were gaining strength and power. And what happened? This is kind of like the question, what should we do? But I'm saying, what happened that Christians would behave this way? It had just been 300 years since Christ had ascended. It's only been 300 years. They break in there, they burn the place down, they take the leader out and kill her in public, execute her in public. Something doesn't add up with what I'm learning at church. So what happened? Around this period of time, the 300s and even a little bit before, the Roman Catholic Church began to escalate in power. Now, some of these bishops that were involved in, like, Alexandria, because it wasn't in Rome, it's like down on the south side of the Mediterranean. It's on the Mediterranean where it bellies down. There's a strip of land at the top of Egypt with a lake on the other side, and it's in that strip of land Alexandria is. So it's like a narrow between waters. They had bishops that came from Africa. They came from Egypt. They came from all these different areas. And they weren't all Roman Catholic, but it wasn't long around that time where the Roman Catholics got enough power to make those groups join theirs and become a power. Their power began to escalate even to control the governments that they had parishioners in. And there's several movies I've seen from those different eras, the 1100s, the 700s, the 300s, that the Pope or the bishops dictated to the leader of the town what their decision was going to be on many different topics. And if they didn't, they'd bring their army in. They had their own army too. And it was around that era and even a little bit before where philosophy gets mixed into religion, which is something that we need to be aware of and something we need to be wary of. So in discussing our theme, what shall we do then for the next few messages? We thought it would be a good idea to look at the Gospels and really look at what was taught. I look at the Christians that martyred Hypatia and ask, where is that taught? Any part of it? Where is any part of that taught in the Scriptures? And, you know, in the movie, they've got these guys up there. And I can hear the words they're reading. They're reading the Beatitudes and this and that. But when they come out of the meeting, they condemn the woman and then send out a posse to go find her and destroy her. That's not taught in the Scriptures. I'm not finding that in my New Testament, any part of it. And those bishops were proclaiming, this is God's word. This is what we have to do because this is God's word. And there was no room around that if they deemed something, that's what it was. There was no, let's figure out what we should do. Let's find out what's true. They just brought what they wanted to bring. I need a cough pause button. I only have one. I just have this. So Jesus taught us qualities that should govern our lives. And so did the apostles that he trained. So Jesus comes on the scene, starts his ministry off by picking 12 people to train. And that's the gospel story, is him training those 12 people. Sorry. Even Paul, he considered himself least of all the saints. Now, Paul was an apostle too, but he was brought on later. This is Paul's writing to the Ephesians, the people that lived in Ephesus. Ephesians 3:8 says, "To me, the very least of all saints, this grace was given to preach to the Gentiles the unfathomable riches in Christ." That's a word that you can't say, unfathomable. It's like abominable, unfathomable. But he starts off by saying, "To me, the very least of all saints." So a saint is someone who is baptized. It's not like Saint Augustine, where there's a criteria that is met after a person dies to determine whether or not they're a saint. That's how they did it. But the Bible teaches that if you're baptized, you're a saint. So you can see there's a difference even in a simple term like that. Paul knew that he was baptized, and he also knew that he was a saint, but he's considering himself to be the very least of all saints. He wrote to the church in Corinth, which is in Rome, not Rome, but in Italy, in the Corinth church, in verses 3 through 6 of 15, "For I delivered to you first of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, and that he was buried, and that he was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12. After that, appeared to more than 500 brethren at one time. Most of them remain until now, but some have fallen asleep. Some have died since." And this is, I was going to 9. "Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles. Last of all, as to one untimely born," this is Paul speaking of himself, "he appeared to me also. For I am the least of the apostles and not fit to be called an apostle, because I persecuted the church of God." So if you remember the story of Paul and his conversion, Jesus had already ascended before Paul was converted. He was still persecuting Christians after Jesus had ascended, after his 40 days after his resurrection. And he was going around killing Christians or putting them in prison, whatever he could do to make smaller the church growth. Then he was blinded and converted. You may remember that story, you may not. If you don't, look it up and read about it. But he was considering himself the least of all people because of what he did, because he persecuted the church of God. First Corinthians was written up like 5 years before Ephesians. So his idea of being least is steeped into his character. Remember, Jesus teaches things that we should put into our lives, to practice in our lives, to make our character like his. So one of the things that was steeped into Paul's character is that he was small or low. Our songs that we sang this morning was, "My God is so big, but we don't sing it, but we are so small." Zacchaeus was a wee man. Only a boy named David. They're small people. So in his character, humility is in his long game. He is a low person. Jesus also taught about being last or least. We'll examine out of Matthew 23, verses 8 through 12. "But do not be called rabbi." These are Jesus' words. This is a black red letter edition. if I can say that. Do not be called rabbi, for one is your teacher, and you are all brothers. Do not call anyone on earth your father, for one is your father, he who is in heaven. Do not be called leaders, for one is your leader, that is Christ. So Christ is the leader of the church. God is the leader of Christ. But the greatest of among you shall be your servant. Now that's something different. Doesn't sound like the situation at the Agora. But the one who exalts himself shall be humbled, and whoever humbles himself shall be exalted. So that's Jesus' teaching about what our character should be as far as humility goes. Humility is the trait or action we are taught to have here. In here, it's the trait that we are taught to have. I did an AI overview. There's a couple slides of it on the word humble. Humble describes someone who is modest, not proud or arrogant, and often of low rank or importance. It can also mean to make someone less proud or powerful, less powerful. Humility, the state of being humble, is often characterized by gratitude and a willingness to acknowledge limitations. I know some people that don't think that way. Modest and lack of arrogance. Humble individuals are not boastful or conceited. They don't view themselves as superior to others. They're less likely to demand attention or recognition for their achievements. They have a low rank or importance. Humility can also describe someone who is not high ranking or influential, but can apply to things like a humble dwelling, meaning not a grand or luxurious. They acknowledge their limitations. A humble person is aware of their own strengths and weaknesses and doesn't try to portray an image of perfection. So we being sinners is what we ought to call ourselves, sinners. They are willing to learn from others and admit their mistakes. Yeah, I'm one of those guys. I really admit my mistakes. Gratitude. Humility also or often goes hand in hand with gratitude, recognizing that we are not self-sufficient and dependent on others, or we are dependent on others and circumstances. Humility is a virtue. Many cultures and religions value humility as a positive trait, seeing that it is a sign of wisdom, grace, and good character. So humility is part of is a trait that would be in our character. And it means that we're not lording ourselves over someone else. We're trying to go in lower than the people that are around us. We're trying to make ourselves lower. Jesus gives another lesson in Matthew 18 about humility. And these are the verses where he does it. At this time, the disciples came to Jesus and said, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" They were wanting to be the best and the greatest. They would argue about it. There are different places in the Bible where they argue about which one's going to be first, which one's not. He called a child unto himself, and he set them before them, and he said, "Truly I say unto you, unless you are converted and become like children, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever then humbles himself as this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." So you have to be small to get large. "Whoever receives one such child in my name receives me, but whoever causes one of these children who believe in me to stumble, it would be better for them for him to have a heavy millstone hung around his neck and be drowned in the sea." So it's something that we don't want to do is be a stumbling block for someone else. The Greek word for humble in this verse 4 is T-A-P-I-N-O-O. I don't know how you say it because I don't speak Greek. But it means to make low. So being small has to do with understanding his lesson here. You need to be small, like with the children. And it sounds like Jesus was, which he sometimes did, was a play on words. He uses a small child to show us to be small or to be humble or to make low. One thing that comes to mind when I read to be low it makes me think of those people that it records in the Bible here and there, where those people that bowed down before the Lord, they went all the way to the ground. And in some cases, it says they fell on their face. And when I was a little kid, I thought, wow, why would they do that? That's got to hurt. But I don't think that's what it means. I think it means they put their face all the way to the ground. How much lower can they go? Jesus is the perfect example of humility as described here in Philippians 2:8. Being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. That's Philippians 2:8. Speaking of Jesus. Jesus, the only man to never sin, thought himself low enough to claim our sins. That's kind of a big analogy or a big statement as to how Jesus thought and what he did for us. And Jesus shows us how important humility is in John 13. I said maybe the last time I preached or the time before, it might have been the last time, we were going over the Easter story was coming up, the Resurrection Sunday was coming up, and I went through three of the four Gospels, and I said this, 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 and this out of the three Gospels, which were all very similar in that story, but John is very different, and I said that. John is very different, so I want to go over that one part that is different this morning. About John. Okay, you guys. So we have an illustration we're going to do here. And then we're going to go over the verses. Where's Brooklyn? You can go first. This is in John 13. In case you don't know, you can turn it and look at it if you want. It's 1 through 17. We're going to go over the verses after this. I'll use one of these harder ones first. And this is described in the story of John 13, where Jesus washed the feet of his disciples. I'm not saying I'm Jesus, but this is what he did. He took the towel that he was girded with and dried them off. Carter, Alex. They didn't rehearse. How much lower can you get than that? I chose these two guys because they were baptized already. Yeah. Yeah, you have to whisper. It's his. So now I want to look at the verses about what we just did. There's a couple things about humility in there before we even get to the verses. One is, how much lower can you go than to wash someone's feet? The other thing is, I don't want you looking at my feet. I'm too proud for that. In our society, that's how it would be. But I have this broken, that we're going to go 1 to 17. I have this broken in little segments because it would be too small of type. So I'll just read it to you, and then you can think about that. I have a few comments about it. And then, so John 13, 1 through 4 says, "Now before the feast of the Passover, which is the Last Supper, Jesus, knowing that his hour had come, that he would depart out of this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end," talking about his 12. "During supper, the devil had already put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, the son of Simon, to betray him. Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things to his hands and that he had come forth from God and was going back to God, got up from supper, laid aside his garments," we didn't do that part, "and taking a towel, he girded himself. Then he poured water into the basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel which he was girded. So he came to Simon Peter," I don't know what number he was, but when he got to Simon, and you kind of know that Simon had a spunky attitude, "he came to Simon and he said, 'Lord, do you wash my feet?' Simon said to Jesus, and Jesus answered to him, 'What I do, you do not realize now, but you will understand hereafter.' Peter said to him, 'Never shall you wash my feet.'" See, that was the wrong thing. Jesus was high, Simon was low, is how he was thinking. And then Jesus answered to him and said, "If I do not wash you, you have no part with me." Simon Peter said to him, "Then don't wash my feet only, but wash everything, my hands and my head." And Jesus said unto him, "He who has bathed needs not only to wash, or needs only to wash his feet, but is completely clean. You are clean, but not all of you." And he wasn't talking about a part of the body, as you see from here. "For he knew the one who was going to betray him. For this reason, he said, 'Not all of you are clean.'" So he was talking about Judas Iscariot. "So when he had washed their feet and taken his garments and reclined at the table again, he said to them, 'Do you know what I have done to you? You call me Master and Lord, and you are right, for so I am. If then the Lord and Teacher washed your feet, you ought also wash one another's feet. For I gave you an example that you should do as I did to you. Truly I say to you, a slave is not greater than his master, nor the one who is sent greater than the one who sent him. For if you know these things, you are blessed if you do them." And that's John 13, 1 through 17. And we acted it out so you would see what that looked like, although there were 12 of them. So I was taught or told that this was a custom of washing feet that they did in those days because people wore sandals. So they would go into a house. The first thing that would happen is the owner of the house or whoever's responsible for the house would wash the person's feet because they were out in the dust, and they would go in their house barefoot. But when I read these verses, it's not that. They got up from supper to do whatever this was. And it's about humility and about being lower. It's not about a custom to do in somebody's house that everybody's doing. This is something that is different than that. So are we using tradition to dictate what Christ teaches? Is this an institution that Christ started? It's a question. Remember, it was Jesus' last night before his crucifixion that he was making sure they got the messages they needed before they were on their own. So here are some self-checks. How are we showing humility in our lives? Are we listening to others? Do we admit when we're wrong? Do we apologize sincerely? Here's a hard one. Are we open to criticism? Do we give of our time or our money to others? Are we thankful? Here's a little tongue-in-cheek one. Are we trying to be first in line at the dinner, which is next? What I saw in that movie was not humble or not humility. What does our Christianity look like to those that are around us? Let's close with song number 291, I Need Thee Every Hour. 291.